you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow addicts? It is Ralph Sutton, the SDR show, part of the Double Penetration, as we like to call it. We do shows every Wednesday, every Saturday that stream live, 9 p.m. Eastern time at gasdigitalnetwork.com/live. Or if you want, you could hear the show 5 days earlier than its release by subscribing at gasdigitalnetwork.com. If you miss the live show, you use the code SDR, you get 20% off and access to every single show on the network from when they started till today in HD without commercials, all on gasdigitalnetwork.com. Right now, a really fascinating guy. Not only does he have a new movie out that he wrote with Billy Crystal, starring Billy and Tiffany Haddish, he was an original writer for SNL. He wrote for Gary Shandling. He wrote with Billy Crystal. He wrote on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Just a super talented writer. I read his book called Laugh Lines and really wanted to get him on the show. His name is Alan Zweibel. My guest host for this episode is James Mattern, who came in and did this show with me. If you're a fan of like old school comedy, fascinating stories from the old days. He was best friends with Gilda Radner. Just so many good old school comedy stories and a really talented dude. Alan Zweibel, the full episode right now on the SDR.
This is the intro to the shit show.
It is the SDR show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll show. I am Ralph Sutton, back with me once again. Now I can officially say probably the most common co-host after Big J. Okerson. It is James Mattern. How are you, buddy?
Baby, I've climbed up the ranks. They said it couldn't be done. I reached for the brass ring and I got it.
I've seen you so much lately. It's crazy. And then Shannon, of course, as always with us, holding up the producer realm, and Ani taking notes. Now, very excited to have this man on. I'm going to read some of his accolades because it really is fascinating. One of the original SNL writers with his hand in legendary sketches like John Belushi's Samurai, Gilda's Roseanne Rosanadana, co-creator of the fucking Gary Shandling show, consulting producer Curb Your Enthusiasm, author, including the autobiography, a book that I loved. I listened to the whole time. I'll tell you a story about that. Laugh Lines, great. 700 Sundays with Billy Crystal. And now a new movie that he co-wrote with Billy Crystal starring Billy and Tiffany Haddish called Here Today. It is Alan Zweibel. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
Good. Very good. I'm going to start with a somewhat adorable, slightly embarrassing story. You, believe it or not, are friends with my mother on Facebook. And she and you, I don't know, I think you do talk once in a while through Facebook. I'm not sure. But she's the one, whenever Laugh Lines came out like a year or two ago, it came out, I think, maybe.
It came out about a year ago.
Okay, about a year ago. She's the one that told me, you need to read this book. She was actually, by the way, close friends with Estelle Reiner. And I think you had a relationship with Carl or Rob. One of the Reiners you have some sort of tie into. I know he's not around anymore, but still, right?
I had a relationship with both Rob and Carl. Rob hosted the third Saturday Night Live ever. Mm-hmm. And we became friends that week, okay, that he was doing the show. And we've remained friends. We did a few movies together. We're doing a TV pilot together now, so many years later. And I met Carl, who was an icon. He, creator of the Dick Van Dyke Show and a 2,000-year-old man. So I knew the whole Reiner family.
Well, that's great. And I know my mom always told me her favorite moment in her life, because she used to run a comedy club in New York City called Upstairs at Green Street. And Estelle Reiner would perform there. And there was a time that she was sitting next to Carl and Mel Brooks watching Estelle perform. She said it was the favorite moment of her life that happened.
We all used to go see Estelle perform. She sang here in New York. There's a place called Michael's Pub. And out in L.A., I forgot the name of the place in Santa Monica, on Santa Monica Boulevard. But we'd all go and see. And Carl would be at every single show. Yes.
Okay, that's great. And so now to
prove that I read your book. I'm going to pull this up, this image from myself here. After I read your book, because I am a psychopath, I emailed you on, not email, but DM'd you on Instagram to tell you there was an audio edit error, and I wanted you to know about it.
Did I not respond?
You did not respond.
You know, this is the first I hear of it. You know, now that I'm such a big shot, I've got somebody who does that for me.
Okay, well, tell him he's slacking because he never responded. I said,
okay, so let's answer it now. What was the audio error?
Oh, so I said, hey, I love the book, Laugh Lines, really great. Just wanted to let you know, on the Martin Short audiobook chapter, there's a section that repeats twice about the boxer sing-along at Letterman, but really enjoying the book. You actually have your own voice, like two sentences repeat twice in a row, and I listened to it a few times to make sure there isn't, it's an audio error in the book.
Well, heads are going to roll.
They should.
Heads are going to roll. So first I hear about it, and I apologize for not responding, because anytime they send me things that they feel warrant a response, I do respond. Obviously, this came in under the radar. Well,
apparently, somebody felt it didn't warrant a response.
Yeah, but yeah. Okay, somebody's going to get dressed down as soon as we hang up.
All right, so you started out, which I love the story. Like, really, look, I'm a fellow Jew from New York, from Brooklyn. You know, that's where I grew up. And
we're in Brooklyn, be honest.
Kings Highway, Coney Island Avenue. They call it Gravesend, but nobody really calls it Gravesend. That's
My grandparents lived on East 18th Street between O and P. And when I was a little boy, when we used to visit them all the time, because we were in Brooklyn, but we were Nostrand Avenue and V, which was Sheepshead Bay. When I'd visit them, we would go to the Avalon Movie Theater.
Right. And I was just in Sheepshead Bay yesterday. I ate at Randazzo's, which is still there for 100 years. I love it. It's one of my favorite places in the world.
Yeah, but they knocked down Lundy's, right?
They knocked down Lundy's a long time ago. But Roland Roaster and Randazzo's are still there. And a moment of true happiness happened to me yesterday. Randazzo's followed me on Instagram. Well, that tells me that I'm really big now. So thank you.
Oh, my God. I didn't realize who I was talking to. Now I'm definitely going to fire that person, but answer your Instagram first.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So you started out writing for the old Jewish people, the old Jewish comics in the Borscht Belt, where I used to go as a kid. My grandparents would take me to those old places like the Neville and Stevensville and Falls View. And that's where I grew up. And you wrote for those people as a young whippersnapper.
Well, as a young whippersnapper, the Grossingers or the Concord Browns. Yeah, we grew up on Long Island. This is after my father had a couple of very good seasons. We moved out of Brooklyn, moved to Long Island. But my parents, on a Memorial Day weekend or Labor Day, they would pile all four kids into the station wagon. We'd go up to one of those hotels, and I'd watch those guys perform. And then when I got out of college, I started writing for those same guys. $7 a joke, that's how much they paid at the time.
It's a good deal. It's a good deal if you can get it.
It's a better deal if you can't get it. But these guys were twice as old as I was. I was 21, right out of college. They were 40, 45-ish. And at first, it was a real kick writing for these guys who, you know, when we used to go up there as kids, I would sneak in to the nightclubs because I wasn't allowed. I was a young kid. Mm-hmm. And now I was writing for them. And $7 a joke. It was, I learned how to write jokes because these guys did not have specific persona. These were just joke tellers.
Yeah.
One would use a joke and maybe another one would steal it. It wasn't specific. That's where I learned how to do that.
And it was the Henny Youngman style of setup punchline, you know, like it was very much, they were jokes. They weren't like storytelling. Is that the
No,
best
there was no storytelling at all. There were few people who did that, but that came a little bit later. It came with Cosby. It came with Robert Klein. It came with Lenny Bruce, where they would tell stories and they would embed jokes in them. Woody Allen, okay, storytellers that had great jokes within the story. The rhythms that these guys had were da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da. Laugh. Okay, that's the way it went. There was a predictable syncopation to the whole thing.
Did you know, like, is there a way to tell if they passed on a joke that maybe they didn't really pass, that they were still putting it in their set and they didn't tell you? Is there a way to verify?
God, they were all thieves. They were they were such thieves. You know, there was, what can I tell you? My they all stole from each other. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I used to hang out at the clubs, this is after the Catskills, and I started hanging out at the clubs. This is in the mid-70s here in New York, the, you know, like the improvisation. There was another place called Catch a Rising Star. Right, this was the new Catskills. This was the new breeding ground. And so that's where you'd see, you know, David Steinberg and Lily Tomlin and Richard Pryor. And there was, I'm not going to mention any names, that there was one guy who did a routine, and another guy afterwards went up to him and said, "Hey, that's my Robert Klein routine." Okay. They would steal from each other, even at that level. But up in the Catskills, years later, when I joined the Friars Club in New York, which was a show business fraternity, those old comics would get up and say jokes that I had written for somebody else. You know, so they right. had like
and the joke would be 25 company. Years old at that point, but it would still be circulating.
It would still be circulating. there was one story that I tell in that book, Laugh Lines, where, you know, I saw Catskills on Broadway. And, you know, I would say the jokes along with to my wife, and we were sitting there. And she says, "How do you know these jokes?" I said, "This is the 30-year anniversary of that joke." Okay,
that's so crazy.
Yeah, these guys weren't exactly freshening up their acts.
In the interest of full disclosure, I stole a few of the jokes from the book, and I repeated them many, many times since reading that book. Especially my favorite one was, "My wife is reading The Joy of Cooking. I'm reading The Joy of Sex. Last night we brought a brisket to Climax." I love that joke. I think that's a brilliant joke.
You know something? That joke was written by a comedy writer who's older than me. He's a good friend. His name is Arnie Kogan. And years later, when he was like the generation ahead of me at the Catskills, okay? And then he went on to The Tonight Show, Carol Burnett, you know, Newhart, a lot of great sitcoms. Now I'm coming along. I'm like about 12, 13 years behind him. There was a comic named Morty Gunty that he had written that joke for 13 years prior. So he takes out the joke, Morty Gunty does. He says, "Alan, this is a good joke that Arnie wrote for me a while ago, but I'd like to freshen it up." So I thought he meant more contemporary books, you know, Joy of Sex, Joy of Cooking,
right.
Well, old books. But no, he didn't mean that. He wanted a new meat. That's because I said, "What, you want brisket isn't new enough for you?" He said, "No, I need a hipper meat."
T-bone's really trending these days.
Yeah. So I put in, I think, pot roast, which wasn't as good as brisket. And to this very day, me and Arnie Kogan talk about who wrote that joke better. And I just concede he wrote it better. I just didn't know any other meats.
Can I just say that old-time comedy seems so much better? Like I'm reading Cliff Nesteroff's The Comedians. It just seems like every comic was an Arnie, an Artie, a Lenny, a Morty. It's the greatest. I'm going to change my name. I'm done with James.
You know, done with James.
I'm now, Lenny Mattern, dog. That's what I'm going forward with.
Cliff has become a good friend, and it just amazes me what he knows about the history of comedy. And he's like a compendium of everything. And there was more of a romance in the world of comedy back then. There was, you know, I think, you know what it was? It was the club era. It was cabarets in New York. And there was something about nightclubs with Martin and Lewis and Joey Brown and people who were really big names in that circuit. Yeah, they still had the same petty kind of competition. I'm sure they were stealing from each other, but it wasn't the race to the TV tube, you know? And it was, you know, maybe I'm romanticizing about an era that's behind us, you know, way back there somewhere, but it does seem like they had more fun. I don't know why.
I just finished that chapter on that, era, the cabarets, and it seemed so much more fun. I also might be a maniac. I read all the pages about if you don't do well, the mob might break your legs. I'm like, I could use that pressure. That would make me a better comic.
Well, you want to know something? There was there were certain places in New York here, you know, the Copa, it was notorious for mob control. And you had to be connected to be booked there. And if you didn't do well, you were out in a minute. And I don't know if they threatened bodily harm. You would have to ask Cliff about that. But yeah, there was something about that era that just seemed a little bit more, at least to an audience, a little bit more carefree. You know, when I think about the Rat Pack, you know, the Rat Pack didn't perform that many times. It was 28, 29 times or something like that. And they just got on stage, those guys, and they fooled around. And there was, yeah, they drank and they made fun of Sammy Davis Jr. And you couldn't do those jokes now because of the whole PC thing. But it just, there was a casual nature to the whole thing where they were in show business and they let you in. And I felt really comfortable with that.
Well, that actually transitions. I want to get into, you know, you were one of the original writers for SNL, first 5 years, I believe. And I love the story, which I want to talk about, obviously, what you just touched on about cancel culture. But first, I love the idea that you wrote 1,100 jokes for your audition or your meeting. And he read the first joke and said, okay, we're good.
Yeah, I had written a joke to show you how long ago this was. This is April 75. From the reference points, I had written a joke saying that the post office was about to issue a stamp commemorating prostitution in the United States. It's a 10-cent stamp. You want to lick it, it's a quarter. And when I typed up the 1,100 jokes, I knew that I put that as the first joke. Then 1,099 came after that. And because in the event that, you know, that would catch somebody's eye, I put the best jokes on the first two pages and the last two pages. All the stuff in the middle was just shit.
You still have the book, though. Did I read that?
I still have it here in a closet. And along with a million rejection slips that I had gotten when I was in college and started sending in jokes to the Tonight Show, the Carol Burnett Show, Mad Magazine has its own folder of rejection slips. Yeah, and I keep it here as to humble me.
So that actually transitions now to, you know, you were there for 5 years. I'd love to hear some old school stories, but before we get into any of that, do you watch it at all? Do you follow it today, like the cast that's on now, and see what's going on with it? Or
yeah,
no?
I watch it every week. I root for it the way I do, let's say, my old high school football team. You know, I mean, I can't play for them anymore, but I want them to do well. And I DVR it every week. And because I'm an old Jew now, I usually watch it either Sunday, and sometimes Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. But by Tuesday, I've seen the whole episode. Mm-hmm. And I'm a fan.
Do you feel, and that what you touched on, like cancel culture in the world we live in, do you feel it's a general, you know, direction that we're just going? Because as we progress as a culture, that's what happens. Because I look at things that my grandfather used to say, and I'd be like, oh, come on, Grandpa, you can't say that anymore. Which now I feel like I'm the person, and the younger generation is telling me you can't say that anymore, which is just a standard thing that happens. Or do you feel that it's just gotten exponentially worse in the past 10 years?
I believe it's gotten exponentially worse. I think that there obviously should be a diversity, and I do think absolutely there are things that are slurs, and we have to clean that up, okay? Mm-hmm. But I also think that there's a hypersensitivity that's out there that you think you're going to offend somebody. I mean, I remember when we were growing up, everyone would make fun of everybody else, and then we go to lunch together.
Right.
That was more fun. And now, you know, for either Jerry Seinfeld or Chris Rock, who I ran into about a year ago, to not want to do colleges anymore. Colleges were always the bastion of liberalism. And for them to be handed a page that says you can't do this, 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 and this topic, I think is bullshit. I honestly do. I mean, satire especially is a reflection and a weapon about society, dating back to Jonathan Swift with Gulliver's Travels. Look at the Marx Brothers. Look at the you look at Python. It's look what people do. That's how we have fun. And if there's a message there, take it. If not, just sit back and enjoy it. Yeah, if something obviously has ill will or something.
Right. I mean, I look, well, I agree with that. That's the general concept. But the thing that I always wonder, because I just remember very vividly, I was like 18 and my grandfather kept using the word colored to describe black people. Right. And I was saying, Grandpa, you just can't use that word anymore. Right. And then I wonder, well, now that I'm 51, am I just out of touch with who the young people of today? Like, I don't know. I mean, of course, I feel if it's done for the spirit of comedy, everything should be allowed. Right.
I agree with you.
But again, we're all old.
Yeah,
you know?
We're old. But is it ill-willed? OK, if it's meant to be to perpetuate a bad stereotype, we should not do that. If it's meant to be insulting or demeaning, we should not do that. But I have we have five grandchildren, and one of them, when he was 8 or 9, came home. He had gotten in trouble with the teacher because he said to another kid, "You gypped me out of a quarter." And I'll go, "Well, what's the problem there?" I didn't know that gypped meant gypsies. And fuck, that's what gypsies do. So you're worried about the gypsies, you know? So I understand it. I get it about the Washington Redskins. I get all of that. Mm-hmm. All right. But I think that a certain amount of logic has to come back. And my hope is that the pendulum comes back towards the middle.
Right. It's funny. I just learned recently that I don't know if you heard this, James, is a crazy one. They want to get rid of the term master bedroom. Because
yes.
Master is tied to the slave era. And I didn't even make that correlation until
I didn't make that correlation. But once I heard that explanation, I told my wife to pay heed. I said, "Listen, there's a reason we call it the master bedroom." And I said, "So no, I can't
bow down before you, basically." Or
I think they call, but there's another name they now use. Oh God, it's like it's generic. I forgot. They told me can't use master bedroom. It's not family bedroom. There's another word that we can't use because master bedroom's out.
Right. We're going to end up at the point where we're not going to have words anymore. And we're just going to like just point to things with our noses. We're going to get to it where everything's just going to be like a beep or two beeps. It's utterly insane. I'm usually like on the side of, okay, man, times change and we need to change with it. Will you tell me master better? I'm done.
Shannon,
I'm quitting comedy. I'm quitting talking. I'm just seriously, people need to quote my grandfather who raised me. People need to get a fucking job. Just get a job. If you're busy, you can't overthink like this. You're actually doing things. Yeah.
I used to have that discussion with my ex-girlfriend. She would always get mad at me for things. I'm like, it's because you're not working. If you were working an 8-hour day, 10-hour day, you wouldn't be focusing on this stupid shit. Shannon, what's the word?
Primary bedroom.
Primary bedroom.
Yo, what if I got side pieces all over, man? Then, I have to rank the prime. No, I'm done. I can't.
But the fact of the matter is, last night I did a book event for a previous book that I'd written with Dave Barry and Adam Mansbach. It was a field guide to the Jewish people. Very funny book. And it was for an event that we were supposed to do live a year ago. COVID shut it down. Mm. They pushed it back a year. It's still not live, but we did it virtually. And there were 400 or so people on. It was very good. But there was a moderator, a much younger woman, and she was talking about her generation with the political correctness and all that. And I, Dave and Adam and I lost it at one point because we were saying, what you're saying is not only not funny, I said, I think that you got to relax. I said, it's as if your whole generation has not had a bowel movement larger or softer than a nickel. Okay. Just sit back, take a laxative and just have fun. Enjoy yourself. And there's no way to enjoy comedy if you're looking at every word, every phrase.
Well, just like,
not everything is meant to be an insult. Have fun with it.
I think we've all at some point been in a relationship where the other person you feel just thrives on drama. I feel it's a generation that thrives on conflict and outrage. And that's just where their heads are. They're only happy if they're complaining about something.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. And I heard what you said about, you know, if you had a regular job, I think that this is a little bit of a symptom of, and I'm not belittling the thought, I'm not belittling the intent, but when you've got stuff to do and not other than just sit around and think of shit, you know, you prioritize your time. How do I want to spend it? And I think that this is so extreme at this point. It's just got to relax sooner or later.
I mean, apparently you're so busy, you can't even respond to my Instagram DMs, you know?
You know, I've got people now, Ralph, you know.
You didn't know now, you get free sandwiches in Sheepshead Bay anymore. Yeah, it would have changed the whole goddamn thing.
All right, before we go any further, I want to tell you about one of our favorite sponsors on the show. It is Yo Kratom, YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo. That's all you really need to know. If you're a fan of Kratom and you want to get good, high-quality, curated Kratom at wholesale prices, there's nowhere else to go but YoKratom.com. And also, I can tell you this, they have custom blends. They have things that are only available from them. No more going to a stupid bodega or a gas station where that shit's been sitting there for a year and a half and you don't know the quality. You go direct to the wholesaler. It is YoKratom.com. YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo. You don't need to worry about anything else. Just go to YoKratom.com. Shannon has blends that she fucking loves that are only available there. One of them has like 11 different strains. Is that right?
Trainwreck, it's called.
It's called the Trainwreck. So you can also not only be smoking the same Kratom, sorry, not smoking, ingesting the same Kratom that Shannon does, but you could be a train wreck just like Shannon. She's a train wreck. Hasn't had sex in 14 years. 14? 18?
Three.
Same difference. Go to YoKratom.com. Again, home of the $60 kilo. And just be a fan of the sponsors that sponsor this show. YoKratom.com. Let's get back into it.
So to get out, you did 5 years on SNL.
Yes.
I like the idea that when Lauren first heard you, he said you were the worst comic he ever heard, but then decided to give you a job, which is great. That's an awesome story. Did I fuck that up at all? That's basically
No, not at all. Because what I did was when I got tired of writing for those old guys in the Catskills, it wasn't my sensibility. I took the jokes they wouldn't buy. I went into the city and the plan was to go on stage, deliver the jokes with the hopes that a manager or an agent would like the material, want to represent me. Well, it just so happened that Lauren was going from club to club looking for writers and actors for this new show that would premiere in the fall. He caught me and he just went right to the material.
That's great. I love that. It really shows his gift of nurturing comedy. Are there any sketches when you were writing those 5 years that you were super passionate about that for whatever reason you could not get on the air that you still think about to this day?
It's not that I think about to this day, but there were a ton of them that I thought were hilarious. There were times where I was the only one who thought they were hilarious. Or I remember that there was one sketch that, you know how, you're not allowed to call them Eskimos anymore. Inuits? Is that what you call?
Inuits, yeah.
Yeah.
Inuits.
Master Bedroom, I think is what we call them.
They prefer to call themselves the Master Bedroom Race.
The Master Bedroom Race, when there's an old person, they put them on an ice floe with all their belongings and stuff and put them out to sea. I had a sketch where it was called Arctic Charter, where Belushi played a very old Inuit and his family came and booked him on an ice floe. And I thought it sucked. I think they let it play in dress rehearsal to prove to me that it sucked. And I don't know how far it got. It may have died after read through, but I remember sort of seeing Belushi dressed up as this fat old, Inuit. So I think it made it to dress rehearsal and there were just crickets. You know,
Can you not say Eskimo kiss anymore? Is that offensive?
You can't say
Eskimo. I don't know if you're allowed to say French kiss anymore.
I had a crowd work bit that used to have that, and I've stopped since we opened up back indoors because I'm like, I don't need a headache right now. We've been inside 2 weeks. I don't need this shit. I don't need to read blogs. I don't need ads. I got rid of it.
It's amazing how you have to keep rethinking words that, I mean, especially as comics. And do you consider yourself a comedian or a comedy writer?
I'm a writer. You know, look, I've been very fortunate that I can go on shows like yours or TV talk shows. and I do, you know, give speeches around the country, you know, and which are funny and anecdotal. But I that's my way of being in front of the camera. I like the act of writing too much. Mm-hmm. I wake up 5:30 every morning with my vocabulary, and I try to figure out which words to put in which order for whatever.
And when words are so important and words keep getting taken away from you, it's pretty wild to think of that you're like,
really... I used to have a lot more words. My weapons are shrinking. You're right. Are we allowed to say shrinking?
Do you think that the fact that your relationship with Gilda stayed platonic the whole time and that sexual tension that you had that she didn't have was part of what gave you a creative juice? Because like you're always trying to impress her and always trying. If you were banging her, you may not have felt as the much of a desire to be as funny. I don't know. You already got the golden goose. You know what I'm saying?
The fact of the matter is, when she declared that we would be platonic friends forever, I've always thought that, especially when you're that age, that there's usually one person in the platonic friendship who doesn't want it to be platonic, but you go, all right.
By the way, with me and Shannon, it's Shannon. She keeps trying to get in my pants, and I tell her no.
Well, I these are the rules. I'll play by them. But one day you'll open your eyes and behold the glory that sits in front of you. I think that for me, a lot of the tension was the sublimation came in the work. Mm-hmm. You know, so we would, when we'd write a Rosanna Dana back then, but with the back and forth of, you know, I'd write a draft, she'd edit it, I'd look at it and go, fuck, it's better than what I wrote. Oh yeah, I'll show her. And then by the end of the day and by the end of the time, by the time she did it on air, that script might have gone back and forth 8-9 times. We weren't talking. It was like, and I do think that it fueled the creative stuff. I also think that it would not have lasted had it been any other way.
Right.
And but, you know, when she got sick, and I mentioned this in my book, when she got sick, you know, she wanted me to make her laugh. That was what she requested of me and my platonic friend. Right. So I remember when I went to give blood at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in L.A., I was on the gurney. And a nurse gave me a pad and a pen. And I go, well, what's this? And she said, well, Gilda likes to know whose blood she's getting. Write her something nice. She's having a tough time. So I wrote, dear Gilda, I knew I'd get some fluid of mine into you one way or another. So that was like basically the essence of the whole relationship right there. But I do believe, you know, look, she became Aunt Gilda to my kids. She was ended up being my wife's best friend and vice versa. I think that... had it been any other way, the whole thing would have been short-circuited.
Right. Yeah, that's what I think. I think it's great. And then you stayed for the first 5 years of SNL. Is that correct?
Right.
Briefly? And then to jump ahead a little bit, talking about always just working alongside legends, you had a great relationship with Gary Shandling. And I think, James, you actually have a Gary Shandling tattoo.
Yeah, I was going through like a midlife at 40, and I came home after a gig somewhat drunk, and I watched part two of the Zen Diaries, and I started crying, and I saw this tattoo on the back of his neck, the Zen tattoo, and I go, okay, I got it. I mean, I had another 3 weeks of existential pain, but now, look at me, everything's better now.
You know something? Your mellowness is coming through my computer screen right now, and I may fall asleep as a result. That was the Judd Apatow two-parter, right?
Yeah.
It was amazing for me because the first part was his stand-up and our show, it's Gary Shandling's show, okay? Then when part two happened, I knew about Larry Sanders. What I didn't know was all the spiritualism. Now, I knew that Gary, even when I was with him, you know, those 4 years, yeah, he had crystals before anybody else did. He had a cabin up in Big Bear, okay, in California, and he would go, he'd meditate and all that. But I didn't know until I saw the second episode about, you know, Buddhism and whatever. When I would have dinner with him, subsequent to our working together and towards the end of his life, I'd sit with him in a restaurant, and he was into boxing at that time. And he would sit there on his end of, side of the table, bobbing and weaving. Me, as the Jew that I am, thought he was davening, okay? And what he, but he, the boxing became sort of a religion to him. And I think that, you know, Judd produced Gary's memorial. And I flew out there with my wife because he wanted me to speak at it, which I did. And we all told jokes. We quoted Gary jokes. It was wonderful and funny. But interstitially between the funny people, you'd have a guy in robes, you know, with the dot and, the, you know, and these were friends and I guess spiritual colleagues, for lack of a better word, with Gary, you know. And I didn't, and they showed footage of Gary talking about writing, comedy writing, but he did it from a Zen place. What he did was he said, you write from the core, get your characters down, get your story down. You can put the jokes in later, but what's the core? What's the essence? And it's something that you sort of learn as you do this a lot, but the way he put it into words and the fact that it was within a religious sort of context, it's something that I think about to this very day. Gary taught a lot of people how to write.
Right.
Judd, there's a guy named Ed Solomon who wrote Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and all the Men in Black movies. You know, they were young writers at the beginning, and they'd go over Gary's house, and they were basically devotees. Gary would teach them how to write.
He also seemed to be, I mean, like you said, so good with his time. There was stories about the basketball games and stuff that they said in things as well. Do you think there's anyone today that is filling those shoes as being a mentor to up-and-coming comedians?
I hope so. If there are, I'm unaware of it. Now, that could be because I live in New Jersey, mm-hmm. and it could be because guys like Jim Brooks are still alive and functional. You know what I mean? Norman Lear at the age of 98 is still at it. You know, mm-hmm. Gary was 30 years young. Well, Gary died. He was 68. Norman Lear is 98 now. So let's say it was a 25-year difference. I remember guys like Gary Marshall. He had all those shows on. His sister Penny was a good friend of mine. She's also passed. Everybody's dead. It's horrible.
Yeah.
But she would say that Gary and his staff would sit at a table, let's say the writer's room or a conference table, and with a stack of scripts, let's say, that were mm-hmm. unsolicited or by unknown writers. And he would say, okay, let's figure out whose life we're going to change today.
Wow. Yeah, that's great.
And go through the scripts and find one. Okay, let's get this guy on the phone. Let's get this woman on the phone. And so to have that generosity of spirit and to know who you are, but also what your powers are, mm-hmm. you know, where you can affect lives. You know, it's I hope there are those. Lorne is like that. You know, there are certain people that recognize what they can do. They remember when they were starting, and they, you know, they pay it forward, and it's really nice.
It's amazing. It really is. I remember also, I forget what the number was, but you said with, I think it was, you were with Gary Shandling, and it was David Brenner that said it. I could be wrong now.
It was the most insane conversation I've ever had in my life.
It's one of my favorite things in the movie. It was Brenner. Am I right? It was Brenner, or am I wrong?
It was David Brenner. Gary and I were casting for our show. I was living in L.A. That's where we were doing the show. Came to New York looking for cast members. And we went to Catch a Rising Star. And David Brenner was a friend. He was older, but he was always very encouraging. You know, and he went to, he had some power in the clubs at the time. If he deemed he was a funny person, Rick Newman, who owned Catch a Rising Star, was more apt to give you a mm-hmm. better time than 2 o'clock in the morning because you were validated. So David, I was always friends with, and we walked into Catch a Rising Star, and David's at the bar. Hey, David. Hey, Gary. He said, come on. So we go over, and he says, and he whispers, I figured out what the funniest number is. So I look at Gary, and I'm looking for a hint in Brenner's face, a wink, a smile, something to tell me that he's kidding around, okay? Mm-hmm. He's dead serious. He says, guess. I said, David, there are a lot of numbers. I don't have this kind of time. He said, you want me to tell you? Yeah, tell us. He looked around to make sure no one was eavesdropping, lest they find out the funny number.
Yeah.
And he whispers, 267.
It is hilarious.
And I look at Shandling. Then I look back at Brenna, who's sort of, you know, proud and going, I figured it out, you know, like that. He's taking little bows for it. And he promised that we wouldn't tell. And I would look at him like he was like an anvil had fallen on his head. And we went to visit him at the home. Okay. I couldn't figure this out. All right. And when Steve Martin read the book, my book, Laugh Lines, where I tell that story, Steve wrote to me and, he couldn't get over it. And every so often, just to cheer Steve up, I'll email the number 267 to help brighten his day. You know,
that's great.
If I help him with that, is that stealing tonight? Can I just grab the mic and go 267 and stare at the audience?
You know something? Awesome. I think the statute of limitations on his ownership of that number has passed. Go for it, man.
I might get that as my next tattoo. I got some space. 267. Yeah. What's that? The funniest number ever. Was there an explanation to that?
Is there
no? Okay. No, there's no.
Shannon,
no.
If you don't understand why it's the funniest number, then
you'll never know. Yeah. No, Shannon, that's the insanity of this whole thing. That's the insanity of. He figured it out. Did he try all the numbers that there are? There's lots of numbers, you know. And if you add one to the highest one, you get a new number, and. I don't know whether he tried a bunch and this was the one that worked, or if he just at this point had a little bit of a tumor. I don't know.
Who knows?
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So, I mean, I have a few other questions, but I want to first transition into the movie that is coming out this week. It's called Here Today, right? And it is starring Billy Crystal, Tiffany Haddish. You co-wrote it based on a short story called The Prize. It kind of seems like, am I wrong to think, because you even mentioned this about why your relationship with Gary Shandling kind of waned, was that your life changed. So your stories didn't feel right for Gary Shandling anymore. Watching this, an older man who's a comedy writer who feels he's losing it a little bit, is it at all based on you?
Well, I appreciate the compliment. No, I'll tell you who it's based on, but not the dementia part, okay? When I was at SNL, there was this really venerable older writer named Herb Sargent. Herb Sargent, if you Google him or whatever, he was a major player at the infancy of television, okay? And later produced a show called That Was the Week That Was. And he was a mentor.
You mentioned him in your book as well. I glorified him. Yeah.
I was joke oriented. He produced Weekend Update, which was all about jokes. We gravitated toward each other. He was 29, 30 years older, but we became friends and he became a big brother, if you will. And after I left SNL and when Billy came along the year that he was there as a cast member, Herb was still there. Herb was like a consigliere to Lorne, okay? Mm-hmm. An elder statesman and whatever. So when we started writing the script, we had Herb in mind as a prototype, older guy on a younger show. That was it. But as we were writing the script, Billy, and rightfully so, says, this can't be just a movie where older guy, younger woman. We've seen those jokes and it's, you know, whatever. On a personal level, you know, My dad started having the onset of dementia. Billy had a relative with the same thing. So we then said, okay, he's this guy. He's writing a book which glorifies, it's like an elegy to his departed wife. He's struggling with it, and he wants to finish the book before he runs out of all of his words. Mm-hmm. Meets Tiffany Haddish. They have a wonderful friendship. But the minute that she diagnoses what's going on, she becomes his muse. So we started with her as the older guy on a show. But then we just totally altered it by giving him this other stuff.
That's great. And you, so I mean, I think I'm right. You're 70 right now, right?
I'm going to be 71 May 20th. I don't know how the hell this happened. I don't know when it happened. Okay?
Do you still feel the desire to keep creating at this point? Like, is it because you've done so much? When you look at, you worked with Martin Short and Steve Martin and Gary Shandling and SNL and blah, blah, blah. Do you still have the desire to get new comedy out there? And are there projects that you are like your golden baby that you want to get out there before you lose?
I run out of my words. Yeah. I don't know if there's a golden baby, but the ideas keep coming. I wake up 5:30 every morning, and I'm working on a script with Barry Levinson. I'm doing a pilot with Rob Reiner, and Billy and I are talking about our next project together. It's the desire to look. Most people in the regular world will tell you that they're retiring so they can write their book. Well, I'm doing it anyway. I'm just going to keep on doing it.
All right. Makes sense. You know, I know what I really loved about your book, and you talked about this recently in another interview I saw, that you would write monologues as if you were other people. Like, you would think of who you were, like, be that person and write their monologue. And it helped you be able to get into the mindset of all these other comics, right? But yeah. You also write your own stuff, like Laugh Lines was your own book and other things that you've done in your own books. Do you prefer the solo path or the collaborative path?
Well, it's a great question, Ralph. There are certain things that can only be written by yourself. I wrote a book called Bunny Bunny, which was an ode to my relationship with me and Gilda. Only I could have written that. A novel I wrote, which was an autobiographical novel, if you will, called The Other Shulman. Only I could have written that because it was very internal. But there are other things where it's such a lonely, lonely discipline where I work a lot now with Dave Barry. We collaborate on books, okay? Any of the other people I collaborate, it becomes social. There's a synergy where 1 and 1 equals 3. You know, in any comedy team especially in writing, you're both similar enough that you make each other laugh and you want to work together, but there's a 10-15% difference in sensibility. So the alchemy works as such where the product is something that neither of you could have done alone. And you get off on that. So I try to balance what I know has to be done by myself with something I can do with another person.
Was there ever somebody you were super enthusiastic, like, oh my God, this is going to be a great symmetry. And as soon as you got to, they're like, God, Jesus, this is not working.
Yeah, there were a couple of people that on paper, it seemed like a good fit. I'm trying to remember who, but, you know, especially after I collaborated with Billy Crystal on 700 Sundays.
You know, it should have been called, by the way, 267 Sundays. Continue.
You know something? The father dies, though. So, yeah, we got to work on that number a little bit. After that show won a Tony, I became desirable to people who wanted to do one-man shows. So the phone was ringing about that. And, I would get these phone calls. God, what's her name? Very nice woman, very funny. She was in My Big Fat Greek Wedding. She was like the mother. Who's that?
No, that's not it. I'll look it up. I thought Kristen Wiig, but that's not it.
Oh, no. Kristen is much young. I can't even remember her name. And you'll know the name in a heartbeat, okay? She, really funny, really liked her a lot. It just didn't work. I couldn't capture her voice. Mm-hmm. It was a dead end, you know?
Shannon, we're hearing you listening to the.
I'm not listening to
that's my phone.
That's not me. Oh.
My phone has the Dick Van Dyke theme song.
Here, it sounded a little Greek. I thought it was,
we thought it was the Greek wedding happening. Like, no, the ghost of her. We don't even know if she's dead because we don't know her name. We thought maybe the ghost came in there. Holy shit. I'm upset I didn't know the Dick Van Dyke theme song.
It's making me crazy that I can't think of her name. She's an...
You said it's from Bridesmaids, the mother...
No, he said from my Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Sorry.
I'm looking at the cast list. No name is jumping out at me.
I know who you're talking about. Kathy Najimy?
No, older.
No, that's the lead.
Older.
Rita Wilson? No.
Older!
Her name's Oma Vera?
No.
I'm out. I'm looking through. I'm scrolling through the list.
Yo, this
no
has
name
become like an Abbott and Costello routine
Maria,
with us. This is
Maria
great.
Portocalos?
No. Older.
Older. Okay. Taylor Swift? Taylor Swift?
It is Taylor Swift. Let's admit that. It's clearly Taylor Swift.
Wait a second.
Now he's looking it up.
Wait a second.
This is the best. All right, I'm at it now too.
I'm looking at it now. I haven't seen you guys in minutes. Wait a second.
Best Messler.
Lainey Kazan.
Yeah, Lainey Kazan.
Okay, I don't know who the fuck that is, but okay.
Okay, she was a big star at one time. She was very funny.
Very confident in this picture. Very confident woman. You can just tell.
I just couldn't capture her. Okay. And she's really nice.
Maybe it's because you couldn't remember her name.
Oh, God, isn't that amazing? I'm at that point now where I'll start a sentence, and about halfway through the sentence, it's like, all right, where was this going? Okay, it's like way beyond why did I walk into this room or where are the car keys? That passed a long time ago.
All right, so let me ask you this. So on this show, my normal co-host is a very funny comic as well. His name is Big J. Okerson, and he challenged me 2 years ago to write a 10-minute set. I can't work it out on stage, and I have to open for him at a comedy club. We were going to do it right before COVID hit, so I stopped. Any advice for a 51-year-old man that's never written a joke in his life?
I think you make that acknowledgement so the audience will be on your side, right? And they'll be rooting for you.
Okay, I like that.
I don't think you try to... dazzle them with
no, of course. I just want to get through. I know it's going to be terrible.
You want to know something? You'll be very winning if you just say, listen, here's the situation. Yeah. I've never done this before, blah blah blah. And I think that there will be a rooting interest. Now, if you tell some stories or jokes that bomb, and you
rest
know,
assured, that
I
will
told
happen.
You I wasn't kidding. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah.
Let them in. Let them in on this hideous adventure you're going on.
Yeah, you kind of have to become Rudy of comedy at that point.
There you are. Become Rudy. Okay. Yeah.
That's a good advice. I like that advice. That actually makes a lot of sense to me because I was literally started writing it like probably the December before COVID. I started for the first time in my life trying to write jokes. And then, became obvious that clubs were closing down and it wasn't going to happen. So I put it on the shelf until the world reopens. I also figure the first 6 months or so of comedy reopening, everyone's just going to be telling COVID jokes anyway. So that's not going to be good for me anyway. So I got another.
Time is on your side here, but remember that. And by the way, the clubs didn't close because of COVID. They closed because they heard you were coming.
Very possible.
Now we don't need this.
Yeah, very
no vaccine for his 10 minutes.
James, before we do the first, any other questions? You got a fucking comedy writing legend here. You want any other questions?
I'm just in awe. I'm just, sir, just so you know, like a year ago when it was just in the depths of this, I went and quarantined in my hometown of Vegas and I would go on like 5-hour walks and that's all we had. And I listened to you on Marin's podcast and I found it very inspiring. And your energy got me like right. It's like, okay, we're going to be good again. And also, I love that you were working, I believe, at a deli, a delicatessen, yeah. And which is good because I always keep that in the back of my head. If it gets to the point where I can't say any words, I can cut some meat, man.
It doesn't push any verbal kind of demands or buttons. Slicing, there's something very therapeutic about it. And yeah, I worked in a deli for a couple of years to supplement. Those Catskill guys were paying me $7 a joke. So this wasn't exactly a windfall. So I worked in the deli during the days, and they had little paper bags that were numbered. as the bags got bigger. The smallest bag were number two bags that they used to sell packs of cigarettes in. If you bought a pack of cigarette, they put it in a small number two bag. I would take them. I'd write jokes, stick them into my shirt, and go home and type them up and catalog them.
But how much were you getting paid an hour versus how? I mean, if it's $7,
I was making more at the deli than I was selling jokes.
He's making $7.01 every piece of meat he cut.
I used to pray for like hero sandwiches and stuff because that was like a full day.
Let's hit the first.
The first time ever I saw concert, did drugs, had sex.
The name of this show, as you know, is the SDR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show. We end the show every time asking our guests with their first experience with all three. We start with rock and roll. And by that, we mean the first concert. It doesn't have to be rock, whatever it was. The first concert you went to on your own volition, but that hopefully we're going to know who it is. Not some local friends group that no one knows, but the first concert you actually went to on your own volition.
Freshman year of college, I went to see The Who perform Tommy.
That's a great one.
Music Hall in Buffalo. And it was life-changing. The album was, the experience was, but yeah, I remember that.
That's a fantastic one. So you said freshman college for like 17, 18 years old, something like that.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Wow, that's great. That's a great one. Fucking A. Now, the first drug you ever did after pot, unless pot's the worst drug you ever did.
No, I did cocaine. I did that a little bit later. And when I started making money, you know, I was really bad with cocaine. My capacity for it, I'm a big guy, but my capacity was so small that I would just, you know, take a sniff here, there, a 2-on-2. And I turned into something really undesirable. Okay. to the point where when I was dating my wife of 41 years, when we were dating, not only would she know when I did coke, she ultimately gave me an ultimatum. Now, it's not like I was an addict, but for me, it was, whoa, that's way too much for you, you know?
All right, good enough. And yeah, I imagine you're not still partaking in any cocaine anymore if you're still—
No, you know what happened? I stopped when we started having children. And it was our first child. And I said, listen, I said this to myself, I can't do this anymore. I'm responsible to the kid. And then I started working on a TV special. And we started keeping really long hours. And I knew that in order to stay up, I would need maybe some help. So I changed the rule. What I said was, for every dollar I spend on cocaine, I will match it and put it in the kids' college fund. Okay. And after about a week, I realized I had enough to go to Harvard two times over. Well, I owed my 6-week old son $1,300.
That's great. And now the first time you had sex.
It was after the Who concert.
It was the same night.
Yeah, same night. So
you got a double dip.
We got a double dip, and we went back to the apartment. It was an apartment that my friends had. I was in the dorm, so I didn't go to the dorm. Went back to an apartment where we all hung out. Oh, how do I tell this? We went into one of the rooms, and the mattresses were on the floor. You know, that's how— that's the setup. And I had sex. And I'm thinking to myself all during it, I'm going, what's the big deal here? I don't get it. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, the woman said to me, hey, sport, you missed. I said, what are you talking about? The mattresses were next to each other. And I put myself, if you will, in the space between the two mattresses.
Wow.
Okay, because as I was doing it, I'm going, this is supposed to feel better, but it's sort of like it's It hurts. It's you know, it's grating my penis.
Oh my God.
What a first time.
You know what's funny, by the way? There's only one other person that had a very similar first story where he had sex with the girl's thigh, and it was Ray Romano. He told a very similar, his at least was attached, the part that he was fucking was at least attached to a woman. Fucking a mattress.
This was a mattress. No, he went for skin and flesh. Yeah. And Ray did that. I figured, you know something, I'm going to try cloth.
Long story short, you dated that mattress for 6 months.
You know something? It came down to between the mattress and who am I going to engage? I had to make a choice, but I went with my wife.
Fair enough. It's good. All right. So the book, which I can't recommend enough, I loved it. It's called Laugh Lines. Get the audio version, hear the mistake that I called out, and then you can also DM Alan and let him know to fix that fucking thing. Maybe he'll respond to you. Here Today, the movie with Billy Crystal, Tiffany Haddish, is out now. You can follow Alan on Alan Zweibel Official on Instagram or alanzweibel.com. Alan, it's very rare to say that, you know, we're all in awe of your legendary writing abilities, and thank you so much for being a part of the show. Did I forget anything to plug?
No, it's great. I had a ball. You guys are great, and I hope to see you again.
We're going to quickly go around the room for plugs. We'll start with Shannon. Go.
Follow me on Instagram at ShannonLee6982 and listen to my podcast. The Thing Is, Ding. We talk about bad dates, fighting, and ghosts.
Do you believe in ghosts, Alan?
Now I do. Yeah, because I want to go on the show.
Fair enough. James?
The James Madden on Instagrams, TikTok, my comedy etiquette, lifestyle podcast, The Commissioner Comedy. Go download that right now. My song that got ridiculed on this wonderful program, Peanut Allergy. Go find it on Spotify. Watch the video on YouTube. Just so you know, it's getting added every day to playlists on Spotify. I'm blowing up, baby. Yeah,
are Peanut the playlists Allergy. Called Listen to This Jackass Try to Sing? Is that the name of the playlist?
I'm not even singing. Just it's a joke with music because I'm talented, Ralph. I hope you realize that. And also, Memorial Day weekend, we are recording extra tracks and filming for my album, Check Spot. I'll be hosting at New York Comedy Club that whole weekend. Come to the show. And then at the end, when you are paying your bills, I will be recording that and having you ask me questions during the Check Spot. We are filming it. We are recording it to add to the 20 minutes I already have of the album. And we're going full on. You can't get half pregnant, baby. Yeah.
All right, Ani, are you here for your plugs? Are you still here, Ani? No, she is.
I am.
Ani, you can turn your camera on. We'll allow it.
All right. Hi, guys. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Ani_Moosh and check out my website at AniMooshMedia.com.
Okay, awesome. Follow me everywhere at I Am Ralph Sutton. My other podcast on health and wellness is called Good Sugar. And Alan, I know my mom has been super much looking forward to this because she's a big fan, and I'm sure she'll be DMing you on Facebook if she hasn't already. And I look forward to you getting back to me on Instagram and apologizing for blowing me off.
I'm not only going to apologize, I'm trying to figure out what gift I should buy you and deliver it to you in person. I'll come up with something.
Fair enough. All right, we'll see you next week at the SDR Show. You mentioned the band, so we'll do it. The song of the week that we always add to the SDR Show comes to the playlist. We'll do Pinball Wizard from The Who. Why not? All right, we'll see you next week on the SDR Show. Peace.
Listening to the SDR Show.